in New Haven. You can join our conversation on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe is out this week, so I've brought in to our New Haven studios, which are very nice, by the way, an all-star panel. We have Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University and a New Haven local, as we say. Hi there, Kalila. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
We also have two journalists who are part of one of the biggest, most important trades made in recent years in the Connecticut journalism industry. Dan Harz, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Hello there, Danny.
Good morning. Together again for the first time.
Neil Victor is political reporter at the Hartford Courant. Hello there, Neil.
Hey, John. Good morning.
And again, a blockbuster trade it was. We're going to start with Connecticut's big political question this summer, one of many that we'll be talking about. Who's going to be moving forward in this race for governor? Now, candidates who haven't already qualified through the party convention process for the Republican and Democratic primaries are now hitting the pavement. They've been hitting the pavement for some time, attempting to round up party registrants to sign their petitions. Here is one of those candidates, Bridgeport Mayor Joe Ganim, speaking to News 12 Connecticut about the signatures he's collected so far.
I think people are going to have a clear choice. Do they want someone who cares and who's sensitive about people who live in cities, people of color, people who have maybe had some challenges in their lives? Those are the people that are signing my petition, by and large, coming up to me and saying, Joe, we want to give you a chance to be our next governor.
Okay, so Neil, we're going to spend some time talking specifically about Joe Ganim and his quest to get on the ballot. But tell us more about these petitioning candidates. Who's out there trying to get signatures right now?
Well, there are five candidates, and anybody who did not get 15% at their convention can go this route. Very Byzantine process of collecting signatures. Republicans need just over 9,000. For the Democrats, it's 15,500 in that range. And it's 2% of party members statewide. And Bob Stefanowski, David Stemmerman, Joe Ganim, Guy Smith, and Mark Loretti, the Shelton mayor, all these candidates are doing the petition drives now. And there are a lot of rules in terms of the people who are doing the canvassing have to be registered with the party that they're collecting signatures of. They have to be a Connecticut resident. When they get the petitions, they have to attest that all the signatures are valid. They have to do that in front of a justice of the peace or a judge or a notary public. So it's a very convoluted process.
A convoluted process. Kalila, what do you think about a process like this? I mean, it makes sense, certainly, to get out there and talk to people in advance and say, hey, can you help me to get on the ballot? And it's maybe a little different ask than, hey, can you give me money or hey, can you vote for me? But it does seem, in Neil's words, to be a bit of a Byzantine system, one that is structured to keep people out as opposed to keep people in.
I think it's a very archaic system. It's very imprecise. We've seen lots of examples in the past of people fraudulently getting these signatures. But if you walk up to me outside of a grocery store and say, hey, are you a registered member of this party, will you sign? I don't really know for whom or for what I am signing. So it doesn't really measure whether this person has the sort of popular support to get onto the ballot. I think there's a better way to do this, and also one that can protect us against fraud.
A better way to do this? Any suggestions about a better way to do this?
Oh, if I had that, I'd get a big consulting check. But I definitely just randomly walking up to people and saying, sign this form, doesn't get at the measure of, is this someone who has the popular support and can really make that investment to run.
Okay, and here's one of the problems, Danny. You know, those numbers come from, as Neil said, a percentage of the total number of registered voters in each party in the state. Fewer numbers for Republicans, that means they have to get fewer signatures. Larger number for Democrats. Here's the big number. The biggest number is unaffiliated voters. An awful lot of people, I think, don't know if they are registered, maybe registered for a party once, maybe they registered in another town. So you're going out and asking people a lot of questions, including, do you know if you're even registered to vote in a party? And in Connecticut, that's kind of a hard question to answer.
Yes, it's hard. I had to look it up myself. although I can name my state rep. I do think that the system that we have in place for qualification for the primary ballot is a very good one. I think it's absolute nonsense that these people are running around. Before they even get to the convention, they say this is a, quote, fixed insider system. Well, guess what? That's what politics is. There only is going to be one person who wakes up on January 3rd as the governor. right? So we don't have a pure democracy free-for-all here. You can't just go sign up. So the idea that you only need to get 2% of the registered voters in your party, that's a function of the closed party system. Right. So if we want to change that system, we can change that system. But don't change the criteria to get on the ballot because you think that something bigger in the system is wrong. The core problem that we have, as you got right to, is the fact that we do not have an informed and engaged electorate. Our listeners here, of course, are the exceptions, all of them. But that's the problem. The problem is not access to the ballot.
But I actually want to go back on that. It's not that necessarily people aren't informed or engaged, although that is certainly a problem in America writ large. There is a different issue, which is that a lot of people choose to unaffiliate with parties. I mean, one way of thinking of it is if you're affiliated with a party, you're more engaged in the system. Another way to think of it is if you're not affiliated with a party, you may well be more engaged with a system that thinks both of these parties are full of crap and I don't want to vote for either one.
I'm going to step in for Kalila and say, here's a better system. Non-party members get half a vote in the primary. Because, see, the problem is that if you open it up, the parties don't have control over who their nominee is. And if you close it, it leads to the polarization that we have now in which the 35% of the people or 40% who are unaffiliated in Connecticut are not participating. Right. So we don't have an answer to that. And there's not going to be an answer since we don't do half votes.
Do you have a thought on this, Neil?
I think that I heard the other day that Connecticut is one of only three states that has this whole convention primary system and that most states go direct to a primary. And as far as opening up primaries, you could have a semi-open primary. I know that there's a big concern, especially among Republicans, that if you just have a open primary, Democrats are going to come in and pick who they feel is the most vulnerable or the most controversial candidate. And there are ways to have, you know, unaffiliated and a cooling off period so that you can't keep changing parties. There are potentially ways to do that.
Hmm. I think it gives us the illusion of having a representative democracy, and it gives us the illusion of choice. And so people don't participate because they know that in many ways the choices have already been constrained for them by having this convention in advance, by not giving people the opportunity. If you can't push through and raise the money that you need to even have a credible run at the convention, then you don't have a real shot. So instead of just, you know, pointing out voters, I think we need to change the structure and the players at the top.
Danny's shaking his head.
Yeah, let me
very
get
quickly,
this straight.
Go ahead.
Let me get this straight. We have a populist president who was elected because he was able to trick his party and he was able to go directly to the voters. And we think that there's not enough representative democracy? I don't think so. I think the system is set up very well to filter the people who should be leaders. And Steve Obsitnik on the Republican side is a very good example of someone who, when they present a very good, strong, solid argument that's cogent, they can get into the system. It's not fixed. It's called the filter that says who should be our leaders. There's nothing wrong with the system. There's something wrong with the electorate.
A quick rebuttal.
I strongly disagree. I think the greatest filter we have is money and the ability to raise money to be viewed as credible. Having a lot of money, having a large coffer, does not make you more qualified than anyone else.
Okay. I just want to move on. I mean, we just talked about people with a lot of money. Can we just go through some of these petitioning candidates? We've got the Stefanowski, we've got the Stemmerman, we've got Guy Smith, Joe Gannon, a very different sort of candidate, which I want to spend more time on. Any sense, Neil, that any of these people are going to have a hard time, an easy time getting to these numbers and what you're seeing from these candidates who are petitioning?
Well, John, there's not a lot of history of success when it comes to petitioning onto the primary ballot. The only person who was able to do it was Peter Schiff in 2010 for the U.S. Senate, and his campaign manager at the time was J.R. Romano, now the state party chairman for the Republicans. Schiff, of course, lost in the primary to Linda McMahon. I think that candidates are learning the lessons of the past and started off the petition drive earlier this time. I think the first day that the signature papers were available was maybe May 1st. And so as soon as they became available, you saw candidates and their representatives getting the sheets to get out there and sign people up. You know, there are anecdotes of 4 years ago when Mark Loretti was trying to petition pushing his way onto the ballot in the lieutenant governor contest to join Mark Boughton as his running mate, that he didn't decide until after the convention that he was going to try to petition. And so you're really scrambling, and you have like 2 weeks to get all these names unless you start right away.
Okay. And one of the people starting right away is Joe Ganim. Of course, he's the mayor of Bridgeport, running for governor. He can't be part of the normal, as we say, processes, the citizens election program. He didn't attend the Democratic Party convention because of his past. Well, part of his past, I think, Dan, might be putting him in a slightly better position when it comes to walking door to door, talking with people in cities and getting people to sign a petition to get him on the ballot. Joe Ganim seems to have something that maybe some of these other candidates don't necessarily have.
Yeah, no, he didn't win. He didn't win the 15% in the convention. He was at the convention, but he didn't come up. He didn't come out with the 15%.
Exactly. He didn't take as active a part in the convention as others did.
The signature process, exactly as you say, is cut out for a candidate like Ganim because his support is concentrated in one place. So they can he and his core supporters probably know 15,548 people in Bridgeport that they can get signed. And so he has a distinct advantage over somebody like Guy Smith or Mark Loretti. Loretti a little bit more because he's the mayor of a city, but that's not a big enough city. Where you're really spread out and you have to just go pay canvassers to go out, I think that's an interesting labor proposition. But you're absolutely right. Ganim will get the signatures, and most of them will be in Bridgeport. I wonder whether there should be a rule that says you have to have signatures no more than half from one municipality. That would hurt him.
Yeah, we're making new rules already. We're trying to redesign the system, Kalila.
Trying to make it more closed, and Kalila's trying to make it more open.
We saw a number of stories, including from our friend Mark Pazniokas this week, who were out there with Joe Ganim trying to collect signatures. And there's an op-ed in the Hartford Courant, Ed Marcus, former party head, saying, you know, you may have actually helped out Joe Ganim here, because here's a guy who gets to walk door to door, say, not only sign this and get me on the ballot, but also make a little case for why he might deserve a vote.
Mm-hmm. I think if you look at urban areas like Bridgeport and New Haven, where it's not necessarily that Ganim is known, but his story is certainly known, having him have that face-to-face time with voters may actually work in his favor. He's been around New Haven a lot over the last week, going to some senior housing units to try to get those signatures and to really frame the narrative in a way that party elites cannot control.
Yeah. What do you see as Joe Ganim's chances in all this? I mean, he gets maybe to this 15,000 petitioning signatures. How does that help him in the election?
Ganim is a great retail politician. He's charismatic. You can see that people respond to him. People in the cities, may have had some brush with the law, so it's not this thing that's completely not viable to them. And I think it's going to be difficult, though, in the primary. If you look at the convention results, Ganim, obviously, he swept Bridgeport, but Ned Lamont is supported by Tony Harp, the mayor of New Haven, Marty Looney, the Senate president pro tem, who's also from New Haven, Ganim got routed here in New Haven at the convention, and so he somehow has to find a way to cut into Lamont in places like New Haven and Hartford.
I actually want to take a pause from the New Haven conversation for just 1 second. You know, so many candidates on every side of the aisle running away from the disapproval ratings of the current occupant of that job, Dan Malloy, who's one of the most unpopular governors in America. But here's one thing that Joe Ganim actually gets to run on that's part of Malloy's legacy. He has said, we want to have a second chance society. And Joe Ganim has said, I want a second chance. And I think that that's not a terrible message to be taking to an awful lot of people who want to hear that message.
Yeah, the question is how you define the word mistake. Someone who robs a convenience store and that is a felony, and commits that felony and maybe serves time or certainly a long probation at the very least for that, has committed a mistake. Now, and I'm not saying that what Joe Ganim did, essentially shaking down hundreds of people who did business with the city over a period of 8 years is not a mistake, but you have to really look closely and say, at what point does something become a mistake that you look back on and say, I was wrong, and at what point does it really get to the nature and character of this person's leadership? There's no question that he is a very good day-to-day mayor. He's good at getting things done in the city of Bridgeport. The broader question is, what is that mistake?
Yeah, and he is very good at talking door-to-door with people about this, as we've seen. I guess I just wonder, Kalila, if that is actually something that bodes well for him beyond his ability to get signatures.
I think some people feel somewhat of a sense of resentment because Ganim can talk about having a second chance, but many of the people who have been trapped in the criminal justice system in this state didn't feel like they had a credible first chance. So the idea that you can go out, redeem yourself by getting a really great job and still having a law practice, there are people in our cities who are saying we can't even get hired in the service industry because of that stain. So I think he has to play that card very carefully and very strategically so that he doesn't isolate people as opposed to bringing them in the fold.
What do you see, Kalila, as the real key issues in the city of New Haven, which is going to be so important coming up in this primary election and also in the general election, the things that people in New Haven really care about, that whether it's a Joe Ganim trying to get his name on the ballot or a Ned Lamont trying to make his case, that people here really want to hear?
I think the big push has to be around economic development, about bringing cities to the area that are accessible to people. Of course, we'll talk about schools in another segment, but also affordable housing is increasingly becoming an issue, and whether people can afford to stay in the cities and actually make a good living here.
How about you, Neil? I mean, are there things that are really resonating here with people on the shoreline that people need to be hearing from these candidates?
Well, I think transportation, Tweed Airport expansion. I think the runway's just a little bit over a mile, and if they can add 800 to 900 feet on the runway, then you can open up expansion in terms of bringing Southwest and JetBlue here. And right now, I think Philadelphia is really the only destination that you can get to out of Tweed, and it's really it's an untenable situation that people in New Haven either have to trek up to Bradley or go to New York to get a flight.
It is also, Dan, smack dab in the middle of a neighborhood. This is not a normal airport location.
It's not a normal location, in part because it's to get to the airport building, you have to go through what I would say is a pure residential street. It's not even like a through street. It's a pure residential street. And the idea that Tim Larson, who is a state senator from East Hartford, but also the head of the group that runs the airport, he's not the airport manager, but he's the head of the commission that runs the airport, he thinks that moving it to the East Haven side and rebuilding in an industrial area a whole new terminal, that gets to be tens of millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars by the time you're finished with that. It's also a unique neighborhood because it is situated in the districts of the two most powerful state senators who both have, let's just say, questions about whether the airport should be expanded.
You've done a lot of analysis about this. I mean, is a bigger, better Tweed New Haven Airport a good thing, something that politicians should be focusing on?
No, it's critical. It's absolutely critical. You can't be the state that has the largest city in the country without its own airport.
Kalila, what do you think?
I think it's complicated in terms of the fact that it's New Haven and East Haven. There are wetlands in the area. It is a neighborhood. But in terms of attracting businesses, in terms of getting people access to those other cities, it will be critical. And that's why I think it's so hard to balance the economic development piece with the quality of life and who gets to make those decisions.
We're in the Wheelhouse today with Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. You're also hearing from Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, and Neil Vigdor, who's political reporter at the Hartford Courant. When we come back, we'll be talking a bit more about New Haven issues, including the closures of schools and the role that race is playing in this election. We are live from our New Haven Bureau at Gateway Community College today in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, and we're live today from our New Haven Bureau at Gateway Community College right here in downtown New Haven. You can join our conversation on our website, wnpr.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe is in Rome this week, which sounds awful nice, but I am happy to be here instead with Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, and Neil Vigdor, political reporter at the Hartford Current. We're going to continue our conversation on Connecticut elections, but hone in on the way that the candidates' race, gender, and age are factoring into statewide races, perhaps like never before. A lot of Democrats had hoped that Ned Lamont would pick someone of color to be his running mate. When he didn't, it reignited calls for a more diverse ticket. The debate carried on this week when Democratic state treasurer candidate Arunan Arulalampam announced that he would not wage a primary against the party's endorsed candidate, Sean Wooden. I'll start with you, Neil. This issue of race at the top of the Democratic ticket is something that we've been talking about for quite some time. How important a role is it playing right now in who is moving forward in some of these races and how the Democratic Party is kind of holding together as it tries to wage a campaign, you know, not against itself in the fall, but against, you know, Republicans?
Well, I think going into the convention, there was certainly this kind of seed of you know, people feeling like that the party, with respect to the treasurer, four of the five last Democrats to hold that job have been African American. And some people are feeling like, why is it only this constitutional office that somebody from the African American community could be put up for? And started to see that again. And, you know, if Democrats are going to talk about the lack of diversity on the Republican ticket, there were those that are kind of doing some soul searching and saying, well, you know, if we keep slotting in certain types of candidates with certain profiles for one constitutional office, that's not a good thing. And so a lot of people were, I think, disappointed with Ned Lamont's choice of Susan Bisewitz to be his running mate. They wanted to see somebody from one of the bigger cities. They wanted to see, you know, a candidate of color. We saw that kind of manifest at the convention in the rise of Eva Bermudez Zimmerman, who got 40% of the delegate vote for lieutenant governor, and she had been a candidate for all of two or three days. And that, I think, would be a troubling sign for Susan Bisewitz looking down the road to an August primary.
So, Kalila, there's so much to pull apart here. I mean, one of it has to do with that this traditional role, right, that the treasurer's office plays in the Democratic Party and in the state, that because we have an African-American, in this case, Sean Wooden, who is in some ways preordained almost to take on that role, then the rest of the party, at least outsiders might say, can say, okay, well, we don't have to worry about diversity at the top of the ticket. This is the job for African-Americans here. It feels cynical, and it feels like not the right way to handle diversity. That said, it does provide diversity. Sean Wooden is someone who's very capable of doing that job, by all accounts, it seems, who's also running against a couple other people of color for that job. In that specific instance, Kalila, is the Democratic Party like looking at this the wrong way, or is there something different that they need to think about when they think about how we balance out diversity on a ticket?
I think the problem is that Democrats have not defined diversity and the fullness that exists within this state or within this country. So it's easy to jump on the bandwagon when someone blatantly disrespects diversity. Hey, Rosanna.
Hi, Rosanna.
Maybe you're listening because you're out of
right
work
now.
Today.
Yes.
Or when people criminalize it in
she'll
the
be
situation.
Tweeting soon.
I'm
yes.
sure. I'm okay. If she's not on Ambien this morning. Or in the case of a Starbucks disrespecting or criminalizing diversity.
Yes.
But Connecticut Dems have to realize that having one black person in office does not speak to the diversity that exists within black communities in this state in terms of ethnicity, in terms of immigration, in terms of sexual orientation, and certainly broadening the lens. So it's not just a black-white binary. That is the future of this state. And if the party wants to remain relevant and actually capture that enthusiasm, it has to tap into that, not just during elections, trying to find the one, but one of many.
Dan, your thought on this?
Well, you know, to get to an organic situation, the so-called post-racial politics or post-racial society that some people were falsely saying.
Good luck
were,
with that.
Yeah, so that some people were. Oh, Kalila's. to get to that point, I think is so. I guess we could say a goal and eliminating things like a tract.
Check back in 300 years.
Yes, exactly. Eliminating things like a tract position. I do think it's unpalatable, the fact that, and by the way, it's not only an African-American nominee for treasurer since 1962 in the Democratic Party, but one from Hartford. Or Hartford, Bloomfield, Windsor, you know,
geographic diversity.
Right, check it off. But so how do you make the system work organically at a time when we have a, we can debate it, and we did debate it in the last segment, a relatively open system. Arunan was able to come in and do very well by starting a year and a quarter ago at the start of 2017 working delegates. And so as a very young person, he was able to come in and make an impact, not because he was of any race, creed, color, or geographic location, because he did a lot of work. Right. And so in a system in which people can come in and upset the status quo, I get that there are people who think that we can't do that enough. But certainly to a degree, it's very hard to also have a sort of organic racial goal or racial diversity without saying this is going to be this position, and this is going to be that position. I think that is part of the problem, is that you have two ideals clashing.
Well, and let me enter in another ideal, Kalilah, that I wanted to bring up. I raised this on last week's Wheelhouse, but I'd really love your take on this as well. So on the other side of this, you have an increasing number of women who are getting into the political process this time around, all across America. And I'll give you a couple of different candidates. Susan Bisewitz, for one, Mary Glassman, who is running for the 5th Congressional District, on the other. Here are two Democratic women who've been part of party politics for quite some time. Mary Glassman's run for a number of statewide offices. Susan Bisewitz has run for, I think, every statewide office that there is, and a few others that I didn't even know about. Now, both of them are in ways being criticized because they are representative of an old guard, and they are white, and there are younger, diverse candidates, African-Americans or people from Puerto Rico, who are coming up behind them, who are gaining a lot of traction and maybe are a different sort of face to the party. That said, if you're also looking for the type of diversity that has more female candidates trying to get into positions of power, it does set up this unusual dynamic in which a Mary Glassman or a Susan Bisewitz, people who've worked pretty hard to be where they are set up as, I don't know, the bad guy in a situation where somebody else is seen as the right type of candidate for the Democratic Party. Clearly, I'm dancing around this because this is all very hard to talk about. We've done this for quite some time, Kalilah, you and I. But, I mean, what do you think about this idea?
I think if we look nationally within the Connecticut context, this is a time when identity can be used as both a credential and a source of critique. So that it's not punishing Bisewitz to say, because you are a white woman, then people aren't excited about your candidacy. But it is about recognizing that there's a difference between being a Democrat and being progressive, about creating a pipeline instead of tapping into the existing one. To think about, a week ago, Georgia Democrats nominated Stacey Abrams as their candidate to run for governor. No one thinks that because she is now the candidate, that means that the old guard racism of Georgia goes away. But it's about the party saying, we want something different, and we are listening to what voters on the ground are saying. I'm not convinced that happened here in Connecticut, whether it was because party elite said, what's going to give us the best chance at winning versus what's going to give us the best chance of creating a more cohesive party.
Well, what's interesting, too, is a lot of people in the national media who don't follow Georgia politics very closely were saying, she's an outsider. Well, no, she's really an insider in Georgia party politics.
Mm-hmm. She's an insider in terms of Georgia party politics. She has the pedigree of most politicians who go to that level. She's degrees from Yale and other esteemed colleges like Spelman. But it does mean that when she comes out to say that my debt should not prevent me, back to the money issue, Danny, that my debt should not prevent me from representing the people of Georgia, a lot of people can connect to that. So let's not just talk about race. Let's talk about class diversity as well.
And talk about age as well. I mean, Aaron Stewart, the 31-year-old Republican mayor of New Britain, who's part of this race for the GOP nomination to be lieutenant governor, she's trying to get to be a part of this. At that party's convention, she certainly was saying, Neil, you know, maybe not the best look for the Republican Party to have some old white guys as the top of the ticket.
Sure. Joe Markley, the very conservative state senator from Southington, he got the endorsement at the GOP convention for lieutenant governor. And immediately after the voting, Aaron Stewart was quoted as saying, having him and Mark Boughton, who is white, who's the mayor of Danbury, at the top of the ticket, that's not a good look for Republicans.
It not a good look for Republicans, Dan? Is it to play out the same way on the Republican side, perhaps around these issues of age, of gender?
Both parties have a problem in the lieutenant governor position with the endorsed candidates. Markley is a really good guy. Everybody loves the guy personally, but he's way, way out of step with the electorate. And so the Republicans have to hope that he does not win that primary. There are two other people. There are just so many issues swirling, and it's not so much a question of picking. In the case of Bicewicz, for example, either person, Bicewicz or Bermudez Zimmerman, wins, the Democrats have a problem. Bicewicz is perceived as not being sincere. And I'm not going to comment about whether I think that's right or wrong. That's the perception. She also doesn't help balance the ticket, either in terms of cities, as Joe Ganim has stepped in and said, look, you have two people at the top of the ticket who are from non-urban places, who are white. Bermuda Zimmerman is a compelling candidate, but she's young. She's had a good 13 years in public life, starting at age 17, but some people say that's not enough. So either way, both parties have a problem at lieutenant governor. The good thing is that in the end, in the general election, people don't vote based on the lieutenant governor.
You actually made my last point for me there. At yes. the end of the day, yes. this is a job that doesn't tend to do an awful lot once you actually get a job. Let's move on to actually this larger issue of race and how it has come up again this weekend with Connecticut sort of at the heart of it. Connecticut, Greenwich specifically, cited in a New York Times opinion piece called The North's Jim Crow. And at University of Virginia, and African-American studies professor Andrew Carl noted the subtle and sometimes not so subtle use of so-called quality of life laws to impose racial segregation. This is something that Lucy Nalpathanch will talk with him about on Where We Live not too terribly long ago. This idea of pervasive racism here in Connecticut, Kalila, and it's something that honestly we talk about when it comes into politics. We don't talk about probably anywhere enough when it comes to just the everyday life.
So as someone who grew up in Virginia, you know, it's interesting to hear people talk about the North and Connecticut. And for me, in many ways, this has felt more like up South than North. There is a certain politeness to how people express their views. There is not the same kind of language choice that we may hear in the South. But it's very apparent that there are certain places where people feel unwelcomed or there is a hostility to their very existence. When I first moved here, we showed up at a home that we were looking to rent, and the homeowner immediately said, I think you're in the wrong place. We don't accept Section 8 vouchers in this neighborhood. And I, you know, thought, wait a minute, I'm a college professor. I was recruited to move here.
But just pause, and let's just pause on that for a second and just think about that. That's something that actually got said to you as you're trying to buy a home mm-hmm. here in the state of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Now, again, you grew up in Virginia. You didn't just grow up in Virginia. You grew up in a town called Lynchburg. Like when you talk about the way words are used, the city's called Lynchburg, Virginia. Right. But yet you're saying that some of what you've perceived and really felt here in Connecticut is every bit as bad or worse than what you felt in Virginia.
I would venture to say it's worse, because in Lynchburg, Virginia, we knew where to go. We knew where people stood. We knew how they felt. And you could navigate in a very open and honest way here. There is the surprise that many students feel when they come here and get to see those invisible barriers that have very realistic imprints on their lives. And so that's the kind of difference, the recognition, but also the coded ways in which language is used to create this us versus them, self versus other distinction.
Yeah, and some of those distinctions, Danny, are still found very much in the voting districts, in the town lines. I mean, we see where people live and where people don't live is very much based on politics and political decisions, decisions that have been in place for many, many, many decades. And these are things that, again, come up when we start to talk about politics, but they're there for people every single day of every single year.
Yeah, to me, as a white male living in West Hartford, it's subtle, but it is possible to see it. I live in a part of the town in West Hartford north of a certain street where, oddly, it's actually one specific street. And south of it, you do find black and Hispanic families, and north of it, you don't. And I've never seen signs of the overt or covert redlining that happens, but it can't be at this point. What are we in, 2018? It can't be a coincidence. And so my tendency is to think that we are looking at more of a classist system than a racist system, and people in a racist way use their classist ideas to attempt to get to where they think they want to be. That may be a racist statement.
Well, I was going to say, I'm going to step in.
I think we're more classist than racist in Connecticut.
I want to get to Neil in a second here. I want to step in, though, just quickly, Kalila, and maybe I'll preface this. My sense is that probably what you hear an awful lot when white men, like the three of us, start to talk about something like this is a sense that it's classist and not all about race, but indeed the racial element is the thing that's actually at the front. The race part of it is the most important, or at least as important as the class part of it.
I think they are deeply interconnected, and I don't think you can separate them out. I think the term du jour is implicit bias. I think that is a way to make people feel better about themselves. The bias is still there. So whether it's called race or class, I don't think you can separate them out, particularly when it talks about the impact on the everyday lives of people who are told in subtle and direct ways that they don't belong.
Neil?
I was thinking about the whole Doug Glanville situation and on the West Hartford line. Guy who played for the Philadelphia Phillies, ESPN analyst, outside shoveling snow, if my memory serves me correct. And you had a police officer, I think from West Hartford, come over the line into Hartford and ask him what he was doing. And, you know, it's that kind of subtle, like, feeling people are out of place. And I know that that really spurred some legislation. And I come from down in Greenwich and covered the beach access issue for a long time. And, you know, I would say that it is a class thing to a degree. I think some people, you know, are resentful that they pay taxes. And so they say, oh, well, this should be our beach. But I distinctly remember Ernie Newton from Bridgeport, you know, saying he was going to bring a bus of inner city children to Greenwich Point when they were having the fight over the whole beach access. And ultimately, the state Supreme Court struck down the residents-only policy and said that it was unconstitutional, that it violated people's First Amendment rights.
Yeah, a lot of the stories in Professor Carl's book really speak to this issue, though, that if a whole bunch of white kids from the other side of town show up at the beach, nobody calls the cops. But as soon as the first black kid shows up on the beach, the cops get called. This plays into our last segment of you know, of the show before we get to our next break, Kalila, and it has to do with how our school systems are arrayed. Here in New Haven, we're looking at, and this is very important statewide, we're looking at the possible closure of up to six schools. Now, several of those schools are magnet schools that were set up post Sheff versus O'Neill desegregation court case, that are meant to join together white students and black students, students of color, in the same schools. And because there's not enough white kids going to these schools, in part, these schools might be closing down. This is very, very personal to you, Kalila.
Yes.
But, I mean, talk about this, about the fact that this grand experiment in building magnet schools in cities like New Haven and Hartford seems to be falling apart.
It's falling apart, and in many ways it is punishing families of color for society's failure to be fully integrated in a residential setting. It matters where people can live, where they can purchase a home, where they can rent a home, because that affects the makeup of their neighborhood schools as well as the magnet schools. And one of the things that we've realized here in New Haven is that the state dollars really follow white children in terms of parents saying, I may put my kid in a public school setting for preschool, but then when I have the opportunity to move them out, I will. Private schools are doing this. My fear here is that instead of just focusing on the schools that may be closed or consolidated. It's time for a broader conversation about what our communities look like now as opposed to when Sheff was decided, as opposed to when Brown v. Board was decided. To look now 60 years later and our schools in many ways are more segregated than they were before. That's a cause for alarm, not because Black children need white children beside them to be successful, but because all of our children need to be educated in environments that look like our country.
I agree with that 100%. It's also the fact that the consent order that followed Sheff never intended magnet schools to be the percent of the solution that they have become. And we're too heavily dependent on this system. Some work and some don't work. There's a certain number of people who are going to come in regionally and want to go to regional schools, whether they're Black or white. And that's a limited amount, and that's part of the problem.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about something we always get to talk about here, but it's still very important to Connecticut politics. Yeah, how are the casinos going? Yes, more casinos coming to Connecticut. We'll see with Dan Haar, who's an editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, with Kalila Brown-Dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University, and Neil Vigdorp, who's political reporter at the Hartford Courant. I'm John Dankosky. This is The Wheelhouse. Okay. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today, we're live from the New Haven Bureau at Gateway Community College. Beautiful facility here at Gateway. You can join our conversation on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe is out gallivanting about the globe this week. So we're joined instead by Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, Neil Vigdor, who's political reporter at the Hartford Courant, and Kalila Brown-Dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Before we get to casinos, very quickly, Kalila, a lot of damage from the tornadoes right around your campus. How are things looking right around Sleeping Giant State Park and Quinnipiac University?
Sleeping Giant, it's I can't even put into words the devastation that is there. It looks like something out of a movie. So we jokingly said it looks like Thanos left Avengers and swept through the park because of the destruction that is there. Campus is slowly coming back together, but it is a real testament that with all of that damage, the fact that there were no lives lost in that area is powerful, but it's also the ways, how do we prepare so if the next storm comes, we can better protect people, not just property.
Yeah, and it's a very important state park and a beautiful place and just total devastation. And so we hope the best for that park and all the surrounding areas. Well, another wrinkle in the state's ongoing brouhaha about opening a casino off of tribal lands. Tribes want to move forward in East Windsor. Others, including labor unions here in New Haven, want a casino in Bridgeport. There's a new development, though. MGM is purchasing Empire City Casino in Yonkers, New York. I don't know, Dan Haar, does that make a Bridgeport casino a little bit less likely?
I think it makes it a little bit less likely politically because it gives an argument to the opponents, as we saw yesterday, a couple of them, although the tribes stayed silent on it. In practical terms, somebody was going to own Empire. Empire is there. And after 2022, they have a moratorium on table games. One presumes that Empire would have expanded into table games and perhaps other amenities after 2022 when the moratorium ended. And so Bridgeport, all along by MGM, was envisioned that expansion. And so in reality, it doesn't change anything in terms of the market. It doesn't change the supply of casino gambling.
It doesn't change the supply, but we've been sort of considering the supply-demand calculus all along with new casinos coming up in Massachusetts, not just the one that's going into Springfield, with more casino gambling coming into surrounding states. Dan, you've looked at this for a long time. Is there the market for all the gaming, I'll say gambling operations that are happening around this region?
I may be the single worst person to ask because I thought we had the saturation point 10 years ago, and apparently not. MGM is betting and said yesterday in my column that we're not even close to the saturation point. The bottom line is that there aren't a lot of people looking to invest $675 million in Bridgeport. MGM does have a tradition of competing against itself. They have 9 casinos in Las Vegas, 9, right? So they're very comfortable having clusters rather than saying, we're not going to compete against ourselves. And as long as they're willing to invest the money, it's not state money, I don't see a reason not to go ahead with it.
So you say they're betting on this. So I assume what the house take is usually about 60%. So it's about 60% odds that they'll be right on this?
By the way, in New York, it's 60% goes to the state. I think maybe we should tighten the screws a little
we
bit.
We should tighten the screws a little bit. I mean, where are the politics on all this right now, Neil, between this this MGM casino, the possibilities for Bridgeport, what's actually happening in Springfield, and some of the back and forth that's happening above the border in Massachusetts about the Wynn casino maybe having some interest from some outside bidders? I mean, where are the politics in all this?
I mean, I think that the Mashantucketts and the Mohegans are definitely feeling threatened up in Springfield, Mass. MGM wants to make last call at 4 a.m. So, if you
this is last call for drinks.
Yes. And so if you, you know, live in Tolland or up that way, where are you going to go? Are you going to go to Mohegan or are you going to go up to Springfield? I think that the emergence of sports betting, is a huge revenue stream that can perhaps offset some of these losses. I also think that a lot of people, when they go to casinos, aren't just going to gamble. It's a whole entertainment experience. They're going for the restaurants.
Drink
they
till
are,
4 a.m.
Only if you're betting. Only if you're betting.
I think that it's not just about table games and slots anymore. It's the whole casino experience.
The whole casino experience, which, you know, is going to include in some way moving forward, Kalilah, sports betting. We haven't quite figured out what that looks like in the state just yet. But, I mean, I always love to talk to you about sports because you're a big sports fan.
I love it.
But one of the problems is that just like we maybe bet a little too much on casino gambling to bring in revenue that we need, we also bet an awful lot on sports in our society. And so now here are these two things coming right together.
Well, I think it's interesting as a wrinkle to this whole have we reached the saturation point argument, because with the easy accessibility of online gaming and online gambling coupled with this sports betting question, do we really need more slots or do we really need a casino to facilitate that? You have places like New Haven that are now considering creating entertainment districts. Will people make that move to go to a casino in another part of the state? I'm not sure. But I also think it's not a sustainable economic development solution to build jobs and build access based on gaming and gambling.
You know, one of the opponents in the legislature got up and gave a speech about what we really need is biotech. And this is not pitting. That's a false dichotomy. I'm not accusing you of this. I'm accusing the idea that the legislature can and should say, no, we don't want more casino gaming because we'd rather have other forms. One doesn't crowd out the other. I have yet to see somebody turned away at the Bridgeport City line, and Mayor Ganim is very good at welcoming in people who want to spend money in Bridgeport because they want to invest in something else. So here's what we got. Do we want this or do we want nothing? That's the choice.
But when you're building a casino, especially a downtown casino, you're basically saying, I want to use our scarce physical resources to do this versus that. If you have a casino downtown, you build up a certain amount of infrastructure. Other types of businesses come up around it. If you build a biotech hub, different sorts of businesses come up around it. I mean, that's reality, and there's a finite amount of real estate.
Yeah, this is like Tweed Airport. The real problem at Tweed Airport is if we build 1,000 more feet of runway, will the airlines show up? It's the same thing with if we build a biotech hub, you still don't fill the buildings. I haven't seen a big rush in the last 50 years of development in Bridgeport Harbor.
Okay, last story for you, Neil. You know, we were talking about staying up till 4 a.m., maybe drinking at the casino while you bet. An issue that is near and dear to a lot of people on the shoreline's hearts is, are the bar cars coming back on Metro North?
So it's official. They have been tabled. They were going to bring back 10 of the bar cars on the New Haven line. And there's a certain kind of Mad Men nostalgia to the bar car. And having your Tanqueray and tonic as you head to Row 8 and out of Grand Central. And I think that, the people who are commuters who take Metro North every day to the city, kind of look at it as, well, my monthly commutation is going up. The trip to Grand Central is taking longer than it did 25, 30 years ago. And we have no hope of getting back our bar cars.
Yeah, the whole idea that this is glamorizing in a Mad Men way some reality. I mean, maybe it's not a bad idea to be able to have a drink on the train, Kalilah, but, you know, Mad Men also sort of glamorize things like drunk driving, domestic abuse, chain smoking, that
there
sort of thing.
There was that.
I mean, do you think it matters whether or not we have bar cars?
I don't think it matters. I think the people who want to have a Tito's and tonic on their commute will do it before they get there. Some enterprising young person in Fairfield County will come up with a way to Uber delivery alcohol at the stop. So if you do that idea, I get a percentage.
I like this idea already. Let's invest in this right now. Kalila Browning, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much.
Thanks to Neil Vigdor, political reporter at the Hartford Courant. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me,
John. And thanks to Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Thank you so much, Danny.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks to Scott Breedy and Joe Koss.